I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. After President Biden and Vice President Harris said the Israeli killing of Hamas leader Yahya Sinwar could result in a ceasefire in Gaza and a release of hostages, Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu told Israelis that the war is not over. The U.S.-backed Israeli assault on Gaza has killed more than 42,000 Palestinians, including 17,000 children. At a press briefing in Geneva today, UNICEF spokesperson James Elder said Gaza is hell on earth for its 1 million children. A senior diplomat working in Lebanon told Reuters that hopes Sinwar's death would end the war appeared misplaced. The diplomat said, "We had hoped, really throughout this, that getting rid of Sinwar would be the turning point where the wars would end, where everyone would be ready to put their weapons down. It appears we were once again mistaken." Today's guest, Eric Reguli, just returned from a two-week reporting trip in Lebanon. He writes, "One minute, the streets seem normal. The next minute, buildings blow up and collapse as Israeli warplanes fire their lethal loads at Hezbollah targets. Heartbreaking to see a country I love shatter and bleed." The Lebanese Health Ministry says 2,377 people have been killed since last October, more than three quarters of them in the past month. 1.2 million people in Lebanon have been forced to flee their homes, including 400,000 children. Lebanon's population is almost 6 million. Eric Reguli is an award-winning journalist and European bureau chief for the Globe and Mail, based in Rome. He's the author of Ghosts of War, Chasing My Father's Legend Through Vietnam. Hi, Eric. Thank you for joining us again.
Hi, Rose. Great to be back on the show.
Well, it's great to have you, Eric. I looked at the photos you posted on your Instagram page, and they're just devastating. Again, just to read the sentence, you say it's just been heartbreaking to see a country you love shatter and bleed. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah, I know Lebanon pretty well. I've been about half a dozen times. I have great friends there. And I was very anxious to go back, and I went back 3 weeks ago for 2 weeks. I've been home 5 or 6 days now. And Rose, at first, I wasn't afraid because the bombing was mostly in South Beirut, which Israel considers a Hezbollah stronghold. The airport, by the way, is in South Beirut. My hotel was about 7 kilometers north of the airport and South Beirut. We heard explosions now and again. We heard incessant surveillance drones over our head. Once in a while, we would hear Israeli war jets going overhead. But I felt pretty safe. But that changed after, I'd say, about 5 or 6 days there. There was a pretty big strike right in the heart of Beirut. Now, this would have been a kilometer, maybe a kilometer and a half, a mile from the hotel. I was there within 2 or 3 hours of the attack, and it was just devastating. It was on a medical center, a civilian medical center, at least 9 dead, many wounded. It was in front of an ancient Sunni cemetery. Dozens of headstones were blown up. And it hit me then that this war was not limited to the south, either to South Beirut or South Lebanon, that the city was under attack. And it was heartbreaking.
What did you see, Eric? I mean, can you just elaborate on the photos that you posted? And for listeners who'd like to see these, we did put a link to Eric's Instagram page at kalw.org. Click on news and then your call.
Well, what I saw, Rose, in this case was they think it was two missiles that attacked this medical clinic, civilian medical clinic. It was on the second floor, and the entire second floor was destroyed. There was concrete everywhere. The streets were rubble. Of course, the impact of these missiles, which are very powerful, blew open, shattered all the windows everywhere around the building. It was complete chaos on the ground. There were still There were police there, ambulances, lots and lots of locals looking at the scene of devastation. I actually climbed onto a roof of a nearby building, and that's where I took those pictures. I was there about 2 hours, but you know, it's life after the cleanup. Life pretty much returned to normal. You know, several hours after the attack, within a few hundred yards, stores were reopening again. So, I mean, you know, war is not alien to Lebanese. I mean, this tiny country sandwiched between Israel and Syria has been at war on and off since the 70s.
Yeah, can you tell us a bit more about that? Give us some background and context. In one of your latest pieces, you begin by writing, "The Lebanese are used to war, deprivation, wealth destruction, mass protests, and political chaos. Life goes on, sort of, in a country that has not felt like a real country in decades."
Okay, yeah, there was a 15-year civil war that started in 1975. It was just devastating. In Beirut, you can still see buildings that have not been rebuilt that are covered in bullet holes, including the old Holiday Inn, which was the biggest hotel in the city. It was 27 stories. It's just there as a hulk and a constant reminder. Then there was the Israeli invasion in the early 80s. Hezbollah, by the way, was created to it came to life in 1982. It's Iran-backed and started growing in the mid-80s and through the 90s to fight the Israeli occupation. Israel and Hezbollah fought a 34-day war in 2006. It was inconclusive, but Israel did retreat. Hezbollah actually claimed victory. Israel did as well. So it was inconclusive, but Israel did retreat. And there's been other misfortunes. In 2020, sorry, there was that massive port explosion that destroyed it killed hundreds of people and destroyed thousands of residences. So this poor country has been lurched from one crisis to another, and it's getting worse now.
According to the World Bank, poverty in Lebanon has more than tripled over the past decade, reaching 44% of the population. Again, a country of almost 6 million people. What about that? How can they deal with this war, given what they're already having to deal with?
Well, they can't. I mean, I actually talked to one of the top economists when I was there, and he told me the poverty rate was actually closer to 80%.
Wow.
And so most of the population, the financial crisis was brutal to the 2019-2020, not the one 15 years ago, was brutal to Lebanon. It was a banking crisis, and it resulted in mass devaluation. So the Lebanese lira now trades at 90,000 Lebanese lira to the dollar. 90,000. The currency is basically worthless. It's now an entirely cash economy, and it's U.S. dollar based. I mean, I do have some Lebanese currency, but, you know, you have to have, you know, a fistful of currency just to buy, you know, a chocolate bar or a bottle of water. And it's just not practical. So the massive devaluation hurt. All the rich people, or most of the rich people, left. There are many more Lebanese outside of Lebanon than inside. The poverty rate soared. And there is no money for everything, because one of the reasons there's no money, Rose, is there's no functioning government. The 2022 election resulted in a stalemate. There is no president. There is an acting prime minister who is a caretaker. And the International Monetary Fund will only lend money to countries that have functioning governments and can negotiate. So there's another stalemate. No money's coming in. And now there's a war, and now there's a huge internal refugee crisis. The term is IDPs, internally displaced people. And it's just overwhelming this country.
Well, given that, Eric, what are people doing? Because we hear that Lebanese people say nowhere is safe, no one is secure. You spoke with people who have been displaced. Bassam Haloum, a water delivery man in Beirut, was jostling his ancient truck through the buzzy, choked streets of Hamra, a neighborhood in the heart of the city. He received a call at 4:30 p.m. on September 20th from a friend in the city's southern suburbs. "Come home now," the caller said. "There's been an explosion." Bassam Haloum, who's 54, said, "I was there by five. I couldn't believe it at first. I couldn't even find my building. Everything was gone." His nine-story apartment building had been leveled by an Israeli F-35 fighter bomber, according to the Lebanese National News Agency. So what are people supposed to do?
Well, I mean, that's a good question. So the bombing in South Lebanon, that will be up to the Litani River, intense bombing. The Litani River is 30 kilometers north of the Israeli border. That's a hell zone. That's getting hundreds of strikes a day. So the southern Lebanon is mostly Shia, and they are moving north en masse. The people in South Beirut, again, mostly Shia, and Hezbollah is Shia, are moving into Beirut and into the cities up north, including Tripoli, which is fairly close to the Syrian border. But there's no place for them. So what the government is doing is turning over schools, hundreds of schools, into makeshift dormitories for displaced people. I was in these dormitories, also hotels. They'll just take over hotels. The hotels I were in central Beirut had no running water, no electricity, no refrigerators, no kitchens, no furniture. I saw in one room there were a dozen kids, and this is a room made 10 feet by 10 feet with a dozen kids sleeping on the floor. I mean, it's just horrific. They have no place to go. Here's an interesting story. We went one day to the Syrian border. That would be due east of Beirut. And there's more than a million Syrian refugees in Lebanon. And Lebanon is now so dangerous that they'd rather be in Syria, which they left during the Syrian civil war a few years ago. And they are fleeing back to Syria now by the hundreds of thousands. Of course, the road is being bombed, the road they use to return. So it's just a nightmare everywhere. There's no money. There's no infrastructure. The schools are closed, which means local Beirut kids can't even go to schools. It's a mess. People are living in their cars. They're getting, tired, hungry, and aggressive. Mm.
We're joined by Eric Regeli, an award-winning journalist and the European Bureau Chief for the Globe and Mail. He spent 2 weeks on a reporting trip in Lebanon. Eric will be with us for 10 more minutes. So if you have any questions for Eric about his trip and what he saw, media coverage of what is happening, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Rima Jamous Imsais, Middle East Director of UNHCR, told journalists in Geneva that over 25% of Lebanon is under a direct Israeli military evacuation order. People are heeding these calls to evacuate and they're fleeing with nothing. She said 80% of the shelters opened by the Lebanese government, mostly in the schools, are now full. So we ask this question every time we do a show about Gaza. How long can that last? What are your thoughts on this, Eric? How long can this last?
Well, it depends how long how far north the Israeli bombing goes. As I mentioned, Rose, right now it's the intense bombing is north of the Israeli border and just to the Litani River. So that's about 30 kilometers, about 20 miles. Of course, Beirut is now getting hit, and there have been some strikes north of Beirut. How long can it last is, I guess, until Israel decides that it's gravely wounded or eliminated Hezbollah. I doubt that's ever going to happen. But this will I mean, my worry is that the aid money is the aid, not the aid money, the food delivery, the medicine delivery will slow down because of lack of funds or lack of logistics. Beirut Airport is still open. Only one airline's flying in there. That's Middle East Airlines, the one I took. A couple of aid flights are going in, but the real fear in that country in terms of aid and medicine and food is if that airport closes because the roads around it get attacked or the airport itself gets attacked. In every war since the 80s, Israel has hit the airport. We are told, I don't know if it's true, but it's certainly believable, that the Americans have told Israel that do not bomb this airport because there are diplomats who need to get out. There are a lot of people who are leaving. They need to get out. The Lebanese are praying that airport stays open. There's only one functioning international airport in the whole country.
And then talking about hospitals and other facilities, ABC News just had a piece about the World Health Organization saying that hospitals and healthcare workers are under attack in Lebanon. According to a recent report, the WHO verified 23 attacks on healthcare facilities, resulting in 72 deaths and 43 injuries among healthcare workers. But this is as of September 17th. So those numbers are probably higher by now. Doctors say that the situation is alarming. Attacks on healthcare debilitates health systems and impede the ability to continue to perform. I mean, we're seeing and continue to see the same thing happening in Gaza, Eric.
Yeah, so the hospitals are closing. There are, I think, five or six hospitals in South Beirut. When I left 6 days ago, one of them had closed. The bigger problem is in South Lebanon. There were four or five hospitals. Now, I'm a few days out of date, that were closed, not because of direct hits, but because the area immediately around them was hit by missiles or bombs, so they couldn't get supplies in or out, and they were just terrified. So they've closed. So the hospital system in South Lebanon is collapsing, and I imagine that doctors are leaving. At the same time, the UN camp in South Lebanon, UNIFIL, they have been harassed and claim that they've been hit. There's been a few injuries there, so. It's a disaster in South Lebanon, and I don't see the attacks giving up, and I don't see Hezbollah giving up in the short term either, because they're dug into the mountains, they are, even though they have been taking severe losses, they do have a lot of weapons left.
What about Israel's claims that they're doing this to go after Hezbollah, just like they said in Gaza when a building or a hospital is blown up?
Well, they are. I mean, they are going after Hezbollah. But, you know, my problem with this is, you know, it's like Hamas. I mean, the Hezbollah is, sure, they're embedded in the civilian population. So there's a lot of civilian casualties. I mean, the other issue is that, you know, Hezbollah are not just an Iran-backed militia. They are a legitimate political party in Lebanon. They run medical clinics. They have charities. They have schools. You know, I don't think those should be targets. You know, the hospital clinic that I saw destroyed about 10 days ago. I believe Israel thought that was treating Hezbollah combatants. I have no evidence that's true. The night I left, there was another massive strike in central Beirut. This one much closer to my hotel, about a kilometer away. And I think 22 people were killed there. And Israel is claiming that there were Hezbollah militants in the building. So there's going to be a lot of civilian deaths to get rid of Hezbollah, that's for sure.
There are a number of reports about the Italian Prime Minister, Giorgia Meloni, telling Parliament that Italy has stopped supplying weapons and ammunition to Israel and has frozen all related contracts since the October 7th Hamas attacks. She also criticized Israeli strikes on UNIFIL forces in Lebanon, calling them unacceptable, and announced plans to visit Beirut soon. How significant is this?
I think it's fairly significant. Now, Rosa, does not mean that Italy is a major weapons maker, by the way. It's one of the biggest weapons makers in the world. There are still Italian weapons going to Israel, but they were those are from contracts that were signed before October 7th of last year. What she's done is she's canceled all contracts, or suspended them, I should say, any of those that were signed after that. So Israel is still getting Italian weapons. But it's not getting as many as it would have had those contracts been signed. Is that a significant? Yeah, because Giorgia Meloni, the Prime Minister of Italy, she's been Prime Minister for 2 years, was seen as very much pro-Israel. She may still be, but I think there's such a backlash now in Italy and throughout Europe. You've seen the protests. That she just couldn't allow these new contracts to be delivered.
What about the United States' role in this? Politico reported just 2 days ago that the top U.S. official working on the humanitarian situation in Gaza told aid groups in August that the United States would not consider withholding weapons from Israel for blocking food and medicine from entering. It was an August 29th meeting in Washington. Lise Grande told the leaders of more than a dozen aid organizations that the U.S. could potentially consider other tactics to convince Israel to allow life-saving aid into Gaza, but stressed that the administration would continue to support Israel and would not delay or stop weapons shipments. What do you hear from people about this?
In Lebanon, I mean, I've been to Egypt, but I'm not covering Gaza per se. In Lebanon, they're appalled that that the weapon flow, the American weapon flow, continues to Israel. There seems to be no red lines. There seems to be no control on the Israeli defense forces, and that's why they're absolutely terrified, because the bombing is going north, farther and farther north in Lebanon. Could this country be destroyed like Gaza? I don't think so. I don't think the whole country will be turned to rubble, but I do think that a lot of civilians will die as Israel tries to eliminate Hezbollah, which started, of course, firing rockets into Israel right after the Hamas attacked Israel on October 7th of last year.
We have one question from a listener who says, do you know, Eric, is the coverage in Europe of this much different from the coverage that we're seeing in the United States?
Another good question. Yes, it is. I think in Europe, it's generally more balanced. Certainly the British press, the Spanish press, for sure. A bit less so the Italian press, but it's starting now. The Irish press, the Scottish press, even the British press, yes, they are much more critical of Israel than some of the North American papers. And TV programs. I mean, we're much closer here to the action. There's, bigger Arab communities in Europe, bigger Muslim community. So yeah, it's hitting home here.
Are you planning to go back to Lebanon, Eric?
Yeah, I want to. I've told my editors I would like to go back. I hope to go back in November. I've got some more trips before then, though. Because I do feel an attachment to Lebanon. I have some of my best friends live there, and you know, I remember my father was a journalist for the Toronto Star newspapers in the 60s and 70s, and he covered the Middle East when we were living in Rome. This is my second stint in Rome, and he loved going to Beirut, mm-hmm. and they used to call it the Paris of the Mediterranean back then, and you can see that, you know, it had the French influence, and it was elegant and lively and sassy and sexy, and that's all gone now. It was cosmopolitan, and it's gone now. And, you know, will it ever get it back? I doubt it. So, yeah, I feel for it.
Wow, so sad. Eric, thank you so much for your reporting, and thank you for joining us. We'd love to have you on again.
Okay, thanks, Rose.
Thank
you. Bye-bye.
Eric Reguli is an award-winning journalist and European bureau chief for The Globe and Mail. He's the author of Ghosts of War, Chasing My Father's Legend Through Vietnam. If you'd like to learn more about that book we had Eric on, you can find that show at kalw.org, click news, and then your call. Coming up after a break, we will discuss media coverage of the U.S. presidential election, which is in just 17 days, and what is at stake. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. We'll be back after this.